This is the World Retail Podcast, the premier platform for global retail leaders, where vision meets insight and innovation takes center stage. From AI to embedded finance, leadership to the ever-evolving consumer, we bring you the voices shaping the future of retail. World Retail Podcast, your front row seat to retail's next chapter.
Hello and welcome to the World Retail Podcast. My name is Ian McGarrigle and I'm the founder and chair of the World Retail Congress. This episode is part of our special series of podcasts produced in partnership with the global retail team at EY. This series is called New Rules, New Retail, Strategies for Future Growth and focuses on how retail leaderships can navigate through the main changes that are impacting the industry in order to deliver that all-important growth. Over six episodes, we will bring you high-level interviews with some top retail leaders to learn more about how they are finding new growth or new ways to deliver growth. Today's interview is with one of Australia's leading and most experienced leaders, Ian Bailey, who was CEO of the Kmart Group and is now chairman of Anko Global, its private label product development division, which supports not only the core business, but works in partnership with a growing number of retailers around the world. I was joined for this special interview by Malin Andre, EY's global retail leader and Nordic consumer and health leader. I very much hope you enjoy this episode in conversation with Malin and Ian. Hello, Malin. How are you? Good to see you.
Good to see you too. Thanks for having me.
Are you in Sweden today? I know you travel an awful lot.
Yes, I am in Stockholm today in Sweden.
Great. Well, welcome to this episode of the World Retail Podcast.
Thank you.
And hello, Ian. Good to see you again.
Yeah. Hi, Ian. Hi, Marlene. Wonderful to be here. Yeah, looking forward to our conversation.
And Ian, I presume you're in Melbourne today.
I'm actually a Sunshine Coast, just north of Brisbane in Australia.
All right. Lovely. Very nice. But so, Marlene, if I can turn to you first. As I said in my introduction, this is the first episode in our series working together with yourself and the EY team. And the series is called New Rules, New Retail, Strategies for Future Growth. And I know it sort of connects with the special knowledge partner report that EY produced and was presented at the World Retail Congress. But really, to start, I wonder if you could give some context in the thinking behind that theme and what issues you particularly see that this series is going to be tackling.
Yes, absolutely. So as the title indicates, we want to discuss how retailers can find new ways to drive growth going forward. And this has become increasingly important over the last couple of years, given the fact that the overall growth in the market is basically non-existing. Retailers are navigating a very complex landscape today with high economic uncertainty, shifting consumer behaviors, inflation, and increased operational costs. And when we talk to retail leaders, especially over the last year, we can see that the confidence has been declining. We actually measure something we call the Retail or CEO Confidence Index. And in December, 67% of the retail CEOs said that they were quite optimistic about the future revenue growth potential in the next 12 months. But when we asked the same question in April, the number of or the share of the retail CEOs that were optimistic was only 38%. So that's a quite steep decline over a 4 to 6 months period. And given this and all the uncertainty, retailers need to find new ways to drive growth. And we see some promising areas, for instance, private label, which is quite mature, but also new business-to-business services like retail media that has grown with 20% year over year over the past 5 years. So we believe that these types of models, even if it might take time to scale, will be important to drive future growth and profitability.
Thanks. And those figures are really quite stark in terms of how CEO confidence has moved in such a short period of time. And you mentioned private label. That's very much going to be the conversation that we're going to be having on this podcast. But Ian, if I can turn to you, everything that Malin set out there as a CEO and chair in retail, do you recognise that backdrop of the challenges that Malin set out there?
I think anybody who's operating in a global context or multi-geographies is now faced with many different questions which weren't there even just a couple of years ago. I think we were all grappling with things like inflation when we came out of COVID, and now of course we've got this geopolitical instability which is making supply chains, I think, increasingly complex, which is probably feeding into some of that pessimism, because the ongoing increase in costs is probably there, but you still have an end consumer in many countries who's not really got increased capacity to pay for those costs. And certainly if you take the US at the moment, it's a very challenging market with the uncertainty of future tariffs and what that means to where retailers should source from, and what it's going to also mean to end consumer prices. So a lot of uncertainty to navigate, and I'd say harder to navigate than some of the previous ones, because not clear, I think, when some of these things are going to really resolve themselves. So you've got to keep on making choices. So if you're a retailer in North America, you've got to keep buying products. You can delay that. You can delay that only so long and run down your inventory. At some point, you're going to have to choose where you buy it from. And with tariffs shifting almost on a weekly or monthly basis, that's not an easy choice.
And you can't pass on those direct costs straight to the consumer, can you, in this market?
So far, it doesn't seem to have done it. Everything that we've seen so far is that there has been some pass through to consumers, but not much. And of course, it comes down to the strength of your proposition with your end consumer. If you've got a very strong business with a very strong proposition and there's the ability to lift prices to some degree, now whether it's fully, I'm not sure. But of course, in the more competitive the segment that you're in, then the harder that is to achieve. And I think we've seen across all segments, right? Not just in the value space, even in the luxury space, that some of the price increases that have gone through have been hard for the consumer to absorb.
It's interesting you touch on the sectors. I mean, for a long time now, the mid-market has been seen as being really under pressure, but we've seen the sort of higher end luxury as well coming under pressure. So is this market really leaning towards the value sector, sort of leading the way, would you say, Ian, first? Maybe I'll come to you, Malin, on that point.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I come from a value retailer, so not surprisingly, I'm going to say yes to that question. But I genuinely believe it. I think there is increasing reasons why people are looking to value, and consumers are looking to value for all the things that we've just covered. And I think what you're seeing is increasingly good offers coming from value retailers. And certainly the retailers that we're talking to in the value segment are very much looking to upgrade their offer without necessarily increasing their prices. So there's a lot of work trying to figure out, well, how do we acquire products for our end consumer that are more on trend, of higher quality, of better ethics, whatever that dimension is that goes to quality beyond just price. I think the value retailer is trying to figure that out. And as an end consumer, when you discover that, why would you go back and pay more later if you're truly satisfied with the various dimensions of the product that are really important to you? So I think you've got the ability for consumers to pay, which is still compromised, particularly in the big mature Western markets. And then I think you've got the fact that the proposition is improving probably more quickly in the value space than it's ever done.
Malin, what's your observation of how the retail sectors are sort of moving? Is it all moving to value, or and what retailers and other sectors, what can they learn from the way the value sector operates?
I would definitely agree with what Ian was just saying. Value is king today, and when we do customer surveys, we see that the majority will continue to focus more on value going forward. The consumers are much more sort of aware, and they do much more research today than they've done in the past. And with all the transparency that comes online with price transparency and so forth, this will also become easier for the consumers to contrast and compare between different products.
I would say just one other thing, Ian, just to add on, is that very much this is the story of North America, Europe, Australia, and other developed markets around the world. If I look at somewhere like Southeast Asia, where we've got some business as well, then it's a different story. There's still the story of the emerging middle class who are looking for the status of brands and looking for the status of value. But of course, you've got the world's retailers are now converging into those locations. So some of the retail propositions there are actually really, really interesting. So I was in the Philippines last week, Very interesting retail environment. You've got the strong Japanese retailers, the strong Chinese retailers, as well as the European and North Americans all playing in the same space. And actually a very energetic and thriving retail market, where the traditional way of opening new stores to get growth is still quite legitimate. So I think when we're thinking about the stock in a global context, I think you've almost got the big mature markets, which are super low growth, but there are still higher growth opportunities out there, depending upon which part of the world you're looking at.
Yeah, and India would be in that category as well. I mean, there's a
Absolutely.
huge emerging middle class. So yeah, that's a really good point. Really good point. So Ian, turning to Anko Global, which you look after, you're chair of it, and it's really fascinating because Kmart had a really developed sort of private label program, which Anko is the division that looks after that. You're now, I guess, marketing those services to other retailers, which is still quite an unusual move, really. It's as not just in private label, but in other areas, retailers offering core services to other retailers. How did it come about?
Yeah, why did we do that? It's a good question. Yeah. But I take it, I guess if you take a step back, we've been very successful in Australia and New Zealand. And for those of you that haven't been or have visited, it's actually a surprisingly competitive retail market. We have many of the best global retailers are here. So we have the Amazons, we have the H&Ms, we have the Uniqlos, the IKEAs, the Decathlons, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we have a good representation of the world's retailers. And we've developed a global supply chain to really service this market. So we're basically appealing to 30 million people, or a little bit over now, in terms of the combined population of Australia and New Zealand. And clearly, the global population is a lot bigger than them. So we figured we were already competing on a global at a global level, albeit at a local stage. So therefore, we figured we should change the stage that we're playing, and try to figure out how we get into new markets. When we looked at the mature markets, as we were just discussing. We thought opening yet more stores in an already crowded environment was potentially a costly and risky strategy. But we knew we had a product proposition that tied into what we think is this ongoing trend of value that we were just covering. And so we think the fastest way for us to do that is to connect with very large retailers who are looking at the value segment and are looking to really upgrade their product offer in that space. And it takes time to do that. We are a ready-made solution that can deliver it overnight, and that's sort of what's happening. What it is what's happening. So we've got products now in Walmart Canada, which have been in the home space, which launched a few months back, and that's very much around products that are design oriented as opposed to just price led. So they're still at incredible prices, but they're very much the latest trends. And then we're doing something similar with Action in Europe, where we're now dropping products in there as Action continues its journey of growth and looks to evolve its product offer, and we're one of the avenues that business is looking at to figure out how to enhance the product offer, which they already have.
So as you've developed it, I mean, presumably you've got quite a large design team that can now bespoke products for a client like Action or Walmart, and the sourcing, I guess, is the other key really important part of it.
A large part of it is the product's already tried and tested. We've already designed the product. We've already, in many cases, we've already dropped product into market, and we've already seen customer reaction, which means we come with a lot of real data as to what that product's going to do. And when you look at the population of Australia, it's a very much a cross-section of the globe in terms of ethnicity. So we found that products that work here actually work very well in most of the other markets we work in, and actually our estimations of volumes are surprisingly accurate. So what we come with a whole bunch of data in addition to a product that's tried and tested, which is quite appealing.
So a retail client can choose from the existing Anko catalog, as it were, because, as you say, it's tried and tested.
That's exactly what we do. So because if you go to a new supplier and you try a new factory, there's always a risk that the product that you order doesn't quite end up being the one that you thought it was going to be for some reason. Where we've obviously got all of that figured out because we've been through that process before. And then what we will do is we will make adjustments to products if there's a different regulation in a particular market relative to another, or there's a specific desire from one of the retailers that there's an aspect of the product that they think would be better if it was changed slightly. But we're generally modifying something to a modest level, as opposed to we're trying to create something brand new and bespoke for everybody else. If we were doing that, we just become a sourcing agent. You know, we become another Leon Fung, and we figure that other people will do that job better than we will.
Right.
What we're saying is we have an opinion on what our products are. We have an opinion as to what we think the trends should be and what the quality level should be, and so therefore this is the proposition that we have, and our partners generally select from that list.
No, it's fascinating. Malin, what's your view? Because this really says something about the changing dynamic, doesn't it, between a retailer and a supplier. And, you know, here we are with Ian and Anko sort of using an existing proven sort of private label program to offer it to other retailers. It's changing, as I say, the dynamic, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. It's quite interesting to look at how the dynamics has changed over the past years. So retailers, they are not just a customer anymore to consumer products companies. They are competitors with a private label, but also suppliers with different business-to-business services like retail media, as we discussed. And as such, retailers are looking more for partnerships, and that's becoming more important rather than just buying products from any company to fill gaps in the assortment. And as Ian was exemplifying here, retailers have also been investing a lot in their data, in their infrastructure, and in the customer relationships. So as such, they've also gotten more control over the full value chain. And 2/3 of the retailers say that they have the upper hand in negotiations today, which was not as strong a few years back.
Yeah.
So definitely a big change there.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, private label has been with us for a while, but I guess we always think of the food area, the grocery area, where it's really developed. So would it be true to say, do you think that private label has been a bit maybe neglected in the non-food product areas for retailers more generally? I mean,
I would say maybe emerging at the later stage. So definitely in food was a bigger focus before. But now when the consumers, as we discussed, are more focused on value, we see consumers trading from bigger brands to private label to a higher degree. And that is definitely changing the rules as well.
Yeah. And Ian, when we say value, it's not, or is it always the lowest price? It's I'm guessing it's not, is it? It's not about price necessarily.
No, it definitely isn't. I mean, I think if you buy something that's low price and not great, it's just called cheap and horrible, and nobody feels good buying that, right? I mean, we've all done it at certain times, haven't we? We bought something and we just wish we'd never spent the couple of dollars, couple of pounds, couple of euros, whatever it was on it. It was just a bad decision. Equally, if you spend the same amount of money and that product surprises customers on how good it is, they love it. So you've got, if you think about that, almost as an emotional scale. You've got the incredible disappointment almost through to elation on the other side. Sounds like a very dramatic phrase, elation, but we see the emotional response when we can deliver a really amazing product at an amazing price that we get. And that's quite addictive. Customers want more of that when they get it. And that sense of excitement is something which we love in retail, of course, because that's why customers come back.
And I would agree on that as well, that it's not about the low price only. I mean, it's a way to faster to respond to trends, but also to differentiate against other retailers and build the customer loyalty. So that's really important. And many companies are also investing in more premium private label, like H&M has their premium selection, and companies like Sephora and other makeup, and also pharmacy companies, they have premium sort of makeup and skincare products. So it's definitely a way both to increase control, drive profitability, but also to create that customer loyalty.
Yeah. I guess it's important to have a high degree of trust and a bond with your core customer to move into these new areas, I guess. I mean, Kmart is established for, offering that value. And I guess you mentioned Action, that's its absolute raison d'etre. And Walmart is about offering that value, isn't it? To be able to add new product areas. So What would you say, Ian, have been the challenges in building and growing Anko as a sort of new entity within the business?
I think part of it is it's some, I think we touched on it right at the beginning. It's not something many people have done. So if you're trying to sell it a service which people haven't discovered or haven't seen before, then of course there's always a bit of a process to go through with that. And we've certainly been doing it. What we found a couple of things as we've gone through the conversations with our many retailers. I think the first one is, if I think about brands, whether it's a product brand or a retail brand where they're essentially the product brand, like a H&M or an IKEA would be great examples. They really understand product development as opposed to sourcing. And I think there's a lot of other retailers who are more general merchandise retailers who have multi-brands and have generally been buyers of other people's products, which they've then sold, have gone into direct sourcing and it's sort of don't quite get product development in the same way. There's not the depth of knowledge of design. There's not the depth of knowledge of actually of the construction techniques that goes into the products that a brand would have. And I think sometimes we come up against retailers that don't quite get that. So where we found our greatest success so far is the retailers which have super clear strategy. They understand exactly who they are. And then when we come along, they say, okay, we get what you do. It's different to us and we can see how you fit. When we go to other retailers, we find it's like, well, you just buy stuff and we buy stuff. So what's the difference? And it's a lot of it is, I think, because of the lack of clarity of their own individual strategy and also an oversimplification of what product development is. Product development isn't, rocking up to the Canton Fair and selecting a few samples and ordering it and shipping it to your country of choice. That's just another form of purchasing. And so I think our challenge with what we're doing is making sure that we adequately articulate the value that we bring and why that value is actually difficult to replicate unless it's part of your core skill set.
So, Manon, are you when you're talking to retail clients around the world, are you detecting, because in terms of looking at new growth and if they're looking at private label, are you seeing people starting to think about it in a more sophisticated way? As Ian says, it's not just as simple as, going to a fair and sourcing product.
No, definitely. And I think what you talked about, it also comes back to this importance of having a true partnership between the producer and the retailers to really drive the overall strategy for the retailers. So we also had a survey with asking retailers, so how do you think the shelf is going to look like going forward? And 73% said that there's only going to be room for one big brand in each category, and the rest will be private label or niche brands. And I mean, most of the times you don't even know as a consumer if it's a private label or not. So, but that's definitely changing the dynamics and this partnership between the consumer products companies and retailers is getting very important.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because we all come from the retail world, we give things titles. So like, private label versus brand as an example. For an end consumer, it's just a product. And
Exactly, exactly.
if it's the right item at the right price, it doesn't really matter
Yeah.
for the label. Unless you want to wear an item or show an item and you want the brand name to be something you associate with and you want to be associated with, that's a different thing. But
Exactly.
if you're talking about a functional, product, if you're talking about a plate for your dinner table, not many people sit there and flip the plate over and have a look at what the brand name is underneath. They just like the design and it fits with their home aesthetic. And so I think what we're talking about here is just trying to find really great products for customers. And I think customers are getting smarter and smarter and saying there's some things I don't need to spend quite so much money on as I may have done in the past.
I want to touch on and come back to, because you both mentioned at the beginning, the global challenges, what's happening with global supply chains, tariffs. Can you both talk about how you see that playing out, if and kind of how you're approaching that challenges? Because it's been, here we are sort of going into almost, dare I say, the last quarter of the year. It's been a tough year of uncertainty around, supply chains, sourcing, and tariffs in particular. So, how has that impacted? And what's the best approach that you've seen? Maybe Ian, starting with you.
Yes, I was hoping you're going to go to Marlin first on that one. It's I think we're still navigating through it. If you take a step back and you say what was the theory 10 years ago, it was that you wanted a global supply chain where you could manufacture once and distribute across the entire planet. That was sort of the gold. I think when you look at how things are evolving, that's unlikely to be the case. And there's going to be an increase in the number of localized supply chains. So I know the US is very topical at the moment through tariffs, but they're not alone. I mean, if you go to India, it's very difficult to import Chinese product into India. And not surprisingly, if you go to China, you've got it's difficult to bring products in from some other countries as well. So I think what we're seeing is increasing numbers of almost like specific markets which are really material in size that are going to need their own nuanced supply chains. And I think we're trying to figure out, is that like 100% separate for each one? Is it a 50% it's the same, 50% tailored to each market? So we're trying to figure out what that right ratio is and what the implications of it are. But I think I'd put that as bucket number one. Bucket number two would be, how do you manage such uncertainty when you've still got to make choices every day? And I think what we were on was a path of trying to figure out how do we balance our supply chain across multiple geographies for geopolitical risk. So most of us were on that path. Most of us had too much product being sourced out of one country. Often that was China, not always, but often. So therefore, there was a desire to balance it. What we're seeing now, of course, is we're getting incredible prices out of some of those countries because there's falling demand because of the uncertainty globally, which is actually making it difficult then for, certainly for us, I think for others, to figure out how to do that that rebalancing of supply chains over time. So you have these two competing requirements. One is to diversify supply chains over time. The second one is there's some really good deals to be done because of the confusion that's in the market and the fact that some orders are not being placed by, particularly from the US.
But you can actually move sources of supply and production reasonably quickly, or because
no,
my assumption is not. Yeah,
no, it takes time, but it's been a strategy we've been on for about 5 years. In earnest, we saw it was probably a 10-year strategy to get to where we really wanted to get to, because in many cases you've got to shift capability from one country to another. You've got to then build scale. You've got to then build the skill set within the new manufacturing partner in the new country. And yeah. Unfortunately, it takes a number of buying cycles to go through that process to get to the position that you want to get to.
Yeah. Marlon, I guess this is conversations you're having all the time with your clients around the world.
Yes, definitely. But we do see a lot of wait and see. There's so much uncertainty. So even if you do scenario planning, that scenario is probably going to be quite obsolete in the next day. But as Ian was saying, the sort of long-term shifts, they are very much true. So the localized supply chains, diversification of the supplier base, and that's going to be a key to sort of hedge for these changes that might come with tariffs or geopolitical shocks. So companies are getting prepared for that. Short term, we see companies moving inventories or setting up legal entities or making sure that they can maybe more easily exit the market if that's required. So there are sort of preparations going on, but since it's so much uncertainty, sort of the actions are still to come.
Yeah. Moving on to another topic, Ian, you touched on data and the importance of data. I mean, data is allied to AI, and that's the buzz phrase, and everyone sort of sees AI as the tool that will help iron out so many of these challenges and cost rises and need for efficiency. Starting with you, Ian, I mean, I don't know, how does AI particularly play for Anko or the wider Kmart group? Is that something that you really do see as being the great future in terms of helping retail remodel itself?
I certainly think it's one of the great tools that's arrived in recent times that gives us the ability to do things perhaps we couldn't do previously. I mean, we'd always been pretty heavily into data in the last, you know, pretty much the last 10, 15 years. And so we've been using, you know, machine learning for some time with our own internal data with to increasing levels of sophistication. And now we're trying to figure out how do we layer on AI in some of those areas, and particularly things around like demand, inventory flows, and so on. So some of the more operational side, if I focus on that as opposed to the end consumer side, where there's obviously plenty of use cases for AI. But I think there's a lot of opportunity in the supply chain itself to continue to find new ways of tackling some of the old questions and getting better answers than perhaps we got in the past. I do think there are some things to keep an eye out on. So one of the things that we started looking at and we're still looking at is AI in design. And there's some pretty neat tools out there, which are pretty basic, you can get off the shelf, which give you the ability to adjust almost, you know, at will what a initial design should look like before you go to the stage of getting it produced and a sample being made in a factory. Now, interestingly, in the last couple of trips around the world where we've done our global research, we're finding the alignment of fashion across the world has never been more consistent than it is today. And so we're trying to figure out, is that a good or a bad thing? And so is there a risk here that we all start using the same AI tools and somehow we start having a convergence of design and actually we start losing our point of view through the process? So anyway, it's one we're keeping an eye out. So I do think as we do look at applying AI, is making sure that we're applying it on the right topics is really important.
It's interesting that fashion tastes are aligning around the world, but are they moving fast? Are they are new trends emerging just as fast?
I'd say it's the same cadence as the core trends are still moving at the same. I mean, there's always going to be the thing, something on social media that goes crazy, sure. and people go after. But if I'm looking at the core trends of fashion, then it's still very much seasonally based.
Yes, yeah. So, Malin, AI. I mean, particularly in this area of product development, is this something you see as something that retailers really need to embrace more than they currently are?
Definitely, and I mean, we've been helping some of our clients to leverage AI to generate product design based on sort of customer preferences and so forth. So that's definitely coming. And I mean, overall, AI is a key enabler to drive the strategy across the whole value chain. Everything from identifying the trends to generating the product design to forecasting the demand, but also to drive operational efficiency, inventory optimization, price optimization, and so forth. So it's really a backbone going forward. And of course, a lot of retailers, they are still struggling, as in other industries as well. So there are, you know, hundreds of proof of concepts and few make it into production, but there's still sort of a common belief that this will be critical for the competitive advantage going forward. But then again, as you said, if everyone is using the same LLM models, what is then happening with the differentiation in the end? So one shouldn't forget the human aspect for retail.
Marlon, question for me is, obviously, when we speak to the partners that we speak to around the world, they're generally big retailers. They've generally got capacity to invest in technology and data. And yeah, and you can see that the really big retailers globally are like light years ahead of everybody else on their capabilities. Yeah. If you take an Amazon or a Walmart, they're incredible capabilities. Whereas when you get smaller and smaller in terms of the retail business, do you think there's still the ability to access these technologies in the same way?
I mean, it is a challenge for the sort of medium-sized and smaller retailers as you don't have the same investment capacity as the bigger retailers. And I think that's probably one of the retailer reasons why the big players are getting bigger and the smaller ones are struggling much more because they have been early on in investing in these technologies, which has been critical to sort of in a better way meet the customer demands and needs, so and also have helped to drive that growth.
Yeah, I agree. One of the things that still surprises me is just how expensive technology is.
Yeah,
from on every dimension, right? The cost of licenses, the cost of implementation, the numbers of people that you need. It's like crazy numbers of people relative to other functions that most of us have in our organizations. So it feels like if there was a revolution, trying to find a way to make technology simpler and more accessible to all would certainly be a great step forward.
Yeah, and then you need to get all the data in order as well, which is a big ask.
Yeah,
and on that point, it's interesting how some I guess the very biggest retailers are now doing what you're doing in with Anko, is they've developed their own in-house technology and are starting to now market it to others. I mean, Walmart has an offshoot, and we heard at the Congress from the Schwarz Group, which owns Lidl, that they've developed their own in-house proprietary technology, which they're now, as you are with Anko, offering those services to other retailers. So maybe that is about tackling the that cost element as well. Interesting. I'm starting to run out of time on this podcast episode, but Ian, you've sort of touched on other growth markets. I was really keen to see or know where you see Anko Global going. And you know, you've anchored it already by saying you're working in Europe, you're working with in North America. But where would you sort of highlight that you see primarily the growth coming from for Anko?
Yeah, I'd say in the medium term, I think the US is a great opportunity. And certainly the conversations we have in the US are probably the most productive that we have in any of the countries that we've had conversations so far. We just find that the American retailers are very, very commercial and just really trying to figure out how to make money. And actually, if you like, ego doesn't get in the way around what they believe they're good at. So I think greater strategic clarity, I'd say, is what we've come across, which I wouldn't necessarily have anticipated that when we started that journey. So we see the US as a really good opportunity. Europe is still an opportunity, but it's a harder sale, just because of the different countries, different languages, and so that's the challenge with the European geography. But I still think really good opportunity. And then the other one, which we're pretty excited about, is Southeast Asia, where we're opening stores there as opposed to wholesaling our product to other retailers. But we're partnering there in joint ventures, and we've opened a number of stores in the Philippines, and it's going, you know, very, very well, albeit super early days.
Which fascia do you operate under? Is that an Anko brand?
Yeah, under Anko. Under Anko.
Right.
So we've got three stores open now. We'll have two more open very soon. And we're sort of starting to think about other countries in Southeast Asia once we get past a certain threshold in the Philippines. But that's really tapping into that emerging middle class of that zone. And yeah, and we're seeing customers resonate well with our products so far. So quite excited about that one too.
Yeah. No, it's fascinating. Marlon, my last question to you, maybe trying to summarise what we've heard. It's been a fantastic, really interesting conversation. And at the outset, we said this is part of the series looking at how retailers can drive growth. I mean, what message would you want to sort of land for retailers that are listening to this podcast episode in terms of product development and private label as a source of growth?
I would say that even though the market is challenging, there are lots of opportunities for retailers, and retailers have shown a tremendous resilience over the last years, even though it's been quite shaky. I would also say that one should try to embrace these new opportunities. For once, retailers understand the value of their assets. A few years back, everyone saw that as a big burden. So the stores, for instance, leveraging them in a good way to drive future growth, the data, the technology, as you alluded to, the supply chain. There's many different sort of assets that could be leveraged to drive additional growth for retailers going forward.
Yeah. No, that's great. So really, Ian, Marlon, thank you so much. It's been a really great conversation. I think, you know, we heard about the challenges, and there's no doubt they're very, very great, and probably not going away anytime soon. But what I love to hear is the kind of resilience of retail and the way that they can find new ways of looking at the market, serving their customers, looking at their primary assets, as Kmart has done with Anko, and as you said, Marlon, with looking at other areas. So thank you both for your time. Thank you for joining this episode of the World Retail Podcast, and look forward to speaking to you again soon. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Ian.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the World Retail Podcast, part of our special series called New Rules, New Retail, Strategies for Future Growth, brought to you in partnership with the global team at EY. We hope today's conversation gave you valuable insights into how retail leaderships can navigate through the main changes that are impacting the industry in order to deliver that all-important growth. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, and don't forget to leave us a review. It really helps others find the show. To stay up to date with the latest from the World Retail Congress and to access more exclusive content, visit us at www.worldretailcongress.com and follow us on LinkedIn. We'll be back soon with more thought-provoking discussions from the front lines of retail. Until then, thanks for listening.